When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. Lots and lots planned for this show. We've got an extensive look at the opening rounds of the 2021 County Championship, a look at how it's going in the IPL, where RCB have raced off to a perfect start, and a look at the new issue of Wisden Cricket Monthly, which includes Phil's wide-ranging interview with Essex and England's Dan Lawrence. To get through all that and more is former England batsman Mark Butcher, managing editor of Wisden.com Ben Gardner, and the editor-in-chief of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Phil Walker. First off, Phil, welcome back. It's been a while.
It feels great to be back, truly.
Wonderful.
It's an emotional experience. I thought I'd been left at the bottom of the queue, you know?
No, not at all.
But now I feel back, feel part of the team.
Wonderful. Feels good. Because you'll no doubt bring it up at some point in the episode, you've been in the wars as well.
Well, yeah, because normally I'd be playing by now, wouldn't I? I'd be certainly in the nets, but no, I have a broken wrist, thanks to Vidushan Hantaraja. He's a fine writer. And a rather clumsy centre back, and he did me in a five-a-side 2 weeks ago.
I'm pretty sure he got the ball.
Yeah, he got some of the ball. He got a lot of the man. He's yet to apologise or even pretend to give a toss about the fact that I've been casted up for the last 2 weeks.
Why would you apologise? I mean, you know.
Yeah, I guess so.
In
fairness, Mark, you weren't there. Okay, it was a nasty tackle.
We're talking about the IPL. None of us are there either.
True. And also, before we get going, a special hello to C. Grecian, our very kind listener in Vietnam, who left a nice review after last week's show.
How many stars?
5-star. And he also picked out your analysis of the recreational game. Not the
Lovely.
Professional game, the recreational game.
That's when I come
game,
alive.
Good. Exactly. Anyway, the County Championship. We're two rounds in. It's been a fun start to the season. I've picked my team the first two rounds. And we'll kind of go from there a little bit. There are a few players in there who you might not have heard of. There are some good stories in there. And some England interest as well. So I've gone for Adam Lyth, Sussex's Tom Haynes, James Bracey at Gloucester, Durham's David Beddingham, Glamorgan's Kieran Carlson, Ben Foulkes, Derbyshire's Matt Critchley, Ryan Higgins, Simon Harmer, Ollie Robinson, who took a 9 for this week against Glamorgan, and Mohammed Abbas. Phil, in the new magazine, we all picked out our bolters for the test summer. You picked James Bracey before this week's round of fixtures, so you must be feeling fairly smug right now.
Yeah, well, broken clocks and all that. I watched that two-day game last year, the inter-squad game, just after lockdown when England had got everyone who's kind of vaguely in the shop window together, 50-odd players, it seemed like, for a couple of weeks. He made a very, very good 85 opening the batting against, obviously, a test-class attack. And all right, it was a trial game and so on. But people were playing for their places there, and there was a definite edge to that game. And he batted really, really well, I thought, against Anderson in particular. He's good against the short ball as well, against the quicks. And I think that innings propelled him into the winter tours. Now, he didn't really get a sniff, I don't think, of making a debut this winter, but they like what they see with Bracey. He can and has opened the batting effectively. He batted 3 last week against Somerset, obviously in a big local derby against one of the top 2 or 3 sides in the country, and he strummed a beautiful 100 and then an unbeaten 80-odd, I think it was, in the second innings. Now, to double up is impressive, I think, especially in a high-pressure game like that. He's very articulate. He's very, very level-headed. His story is an interesting one. You interviewed him a couple of years ago as well. He's not come through the straightforward so-called talent pathway route. But he's got to the top of the Gloucester order, and they're obviously, you know, they're riding a bit of a wave at the minute at Gloucester in four-day cricket. And a lot of it comes down to this player. He's also a very useful keeper as well. I mean, I don't think we need to concern ourselves
with
that.
Yeah,
exactly. every young player is a keeper as well on the side.
Yeah.
But I like the way he sets up. He's a left-hander, as I say, he plays the quicks very well. And when you look to that first test squad, I guess there are one or two possible holes or possible openings in the top three, possibly, especially with Sibley, you know, having possibly got an ongoing injury. I think he was able to bat in the second innings for Warwickshire last week. But again, one or two question marks against him and Rory Burns as well. You know, need to score, and I'm sure there's one around the corner. But if you are looking at that England side, there are one or two areas where players can bolt through, and I think that Bracey is one to look for. I mean, I'm feeling quite smug because I called this one up last week. He'll get a pair next week, and then we can talk about someone else.
Yeah, but people who follow the England test side would have heard of Bracey because he's been involved in a few squads now, especially during COVID. But people might not realise how out of the blue it was that he got picked in the first place, particularly in the Lions squad. I think his first gross average was about 34-35. He hadn't played that much.
That's the new 50.
That's true. He only had a couple Crawley. Of seasons in the Gloucester first team before he got that England Lions call up. That seems to kind of be the trend now, that the England selectors seem to be picking players who might not necessarily have a huge record behind them, but they pick based off what they see with their eyes.
Yeah, I mean, look, that's been the case since Fletch, really, hasn't it? I mean, the often told story of Vaughan and Trescothick. And, you know, part of that comes from having the talent spread so thinly over 18 counties. And that you that at any one moment in time, and this has been the case since I started back in the early 90s, at any one time there are going to be tons of players in great form smacking out hundreds or taking fifers or whatever that might be. And so when it comes to selection, the selectors and coaches and hierarchy need to be able to spot something else. You know, form in a first-class summer in England is something that so many players have all at once. You need to be able to figure out whether or not there is something else that will help them succeed at that level. So with Bobby Bracey, James Bracey, they've obviously spotted something in terms of his character and in terms of his desire and his work rate, willingness to improve, all of those things, somebody that will make it at the higher level. And that's basically the job of the selectors and the guys who are running around doing the spotting, the scouting underneath the big two, or the sort of slightly big one and the very short two.
What is it that selectors do you think are looking for in players who might not have that record? Is it the attitude, or is it ability to play high pace bowling?
I think you kind of, what you're looking for is the opposition and the type of game in which these players are successful. You know, is it a fourth innings run chase on a Bunsen? Is it, you know, playing against overseas quicks? You know, he might have made no runs whatsoever against a nondescript attack on a green one somewhere, but against a test class attack, as Phil mentioned, that Bracey first impressed against, on a flyer in a big contest. You know, all of those things need to go into the pot. It's not necessarily, the numbers don't lie, but it isn't necessarily just the numbers that are going to get you that extra recognition.
And I guess second innings runs, fourth innings runs in this particular instance, that they don't count double, but they do count that little bit more. And I think we'll come on to Dan Lawrence later, but he said that to me. He said, thinking about what he needs to do to establish himself, he said, you know, first innings runs are good, but second innings runs is where you make your bacon.
That's interesting because you could look at it the other way around and go, you know, if you're going to be a successful test side, you don't want to be playing catch up all the time. So making them in the first innings, putting the strokes down on the page before anybody else has had a chance is also very important. You know,
yeah, and Bracey did both in that game. Yeah.
Exactly, and he did both. But also, if you're going to break in. And it doesn't matter where you end up in the test side. Anyone will tell you, I'll bat anywhere from one to six as long as I get that jumper. You want to be doing it in the top three, four in county cricket. Yeah. Outside of that, you're pushing your luck a little bit for test matches anyway.
From a Gloucester point of view, it's a huge win. Two good wins to start the season. And the first win, I think you're saying, at Taunton for them since 1993, is that right? Yeah, and like that's the kind of game that Somerset is. I mean, it's the kind of game that Essex did win this round. It's the kind of game Somerset have got used to winning, sort of close games, but they bat themselves to defend targets. So it does take something pretty special against that attack to go out and play with that kind of ease as well. He was kind of just strumming it around. It wasn't like a sort of a gritty fight towards a total. He kind of just like was like, okay, this is a small total. I'm good enough to do this, and went out and did that. So yeah, hugely impressive.
Just very briefly, feather in the cap, I think, for the conference system, which I know is dividing the game, you know, and it almost down the middle, actually. And while Gloucester would have been a Division One side this year, they obviously haven't been for a number of years, but to see them coming out 2-2, 2-2, that's significant, I think, in itself. And there are other examples, I think, through the game, so through the two games, two rounds of games so
Mate,
far.
I like it. I really do.
Do you? Good, because I do as well.
For the reason that, in a smaller group like that, I know that counties won't own up to this, but in the past, there have been, ever since the 18 all-one division, and then when it went to two divisions, there have been certain clubs who have basically looked at the championship, ridden it off before it's even started. Not that bothered about getting promoted. Not that bothered about, about trying to, to do anything other than hang in where they were. Okay, so that in itself means that all of the clubs in their groups stand a pretty decent chance, if they get off to a flying start, of being involved in the shake-up of making their way into Division One by the end of it. And if you give people the incentive that is close by, you know, it's not a far-off pie-in-the-sky dream, then all of a sudden there is an incentive there to kind of go, hang on a second, we're not just fobbing this one off and looking at the T20s. We're gonna have a right red-hot go at this too. And I really like it. I really do.
Yeah, I echo that. It compels teams that have pushed this to one side out of a sense of survival as much as anything else, with maybe an element of indifference there coming up on the rail, but it compels teams now to take it more seriously. And also, those teams on the so-called lower rungs of the county model, a lot of these players, understandably so, for the last 10 years, have been looking over their shoulder, where else can I go? You know, if I have a good half a season for Leicester or Derby, then where's the move maybe at the end of the year? Well, if you can have a good year now for a Leicester and a Derby or a Northants or a Gloucester, and you can make your mark at test match grounds against first division in inverted commas teams, that secures you to the club that brought you through in the first place. And seeing these players move around as we have done, and the funneling of talent upwards, so to speak, I don't think we'll see that quite as much. And I think that's a positive thing for all the clubs, all the 18. If we believe in the 18, I think we've got to believe in this system.
Yeah, and I think as well, in the past, that people have almost, not totally disregarded, but haven't put as much attention on brilliant performance in Division 2. Whereas now, a lot, if you go through the, I know it's just a team I picked, but a lot of players who would have played in Division 2 for a while. So, Glamorgan's Kieran Colson's quite an interesting player. He's only 22, six first-class hundreds.
Yeah.
Derbyshire's Matt Critchley currently averages 84 with a bat and 16 with the ball this season. I know there's only two games, but Taha spoke to him about an hour ago, and he said a couple of interesting things. One, he doesn't think he'd have played as many first-class games as he had. He's played 55, he's only 24 if he didn't bat. And also that he quite enjoys bowling in April because some balls turn, some others don't. And some people think it's because there's variations.
And he's a wrist spinner.
Yeah, he's a leggy.
Here's one for you, Mark. I'll give you half an hour to figure it out because I can't. First 2 weeks of the season, three English leg spinners have been playing. Crane, Parkinson, Critchley. Can you think of an occasion during your time in the first couple of weeks of the season?
There weren't three.
No. I mean,
there were Sauls, and that was pretty much it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Rash. Obviously later on, but no, I mean, it's incredible. The difficult thing, I was just talking to Matt Thacker next door, with the runs that have been scored around the place. Yes, there have been, you know, Essex got bowled out for 80, didn't they, 79, and then won the game anyway. But you have that combination of freezing cold and no rain. You've got concrete, haven't you? You've got these hard pitches, and the leggies, if they can keep their hands warm enough to wrap around it, they're going to be of use to teams. So it's been great. It's been really interesting to see. And I, as I said, I'm a fan. It also reduces the number of first class games. You know, you're going to get 14 tops, but it means everybody from the very beginning stands a pretty much an equal chance, and you will see. The likes of, you know, we've seen the likes of Gloucester turning over Surrey, turning over Somerset now, that those types of things will not be few and far between. And I'm all for it. All the while that you're not able to fill teams up with huge named overseas players, the more you can get of the 18 counties really ripping into each other in a smaller, shorter championship, the better it is for English cricket.
I've also liked how some of the big name overseas players haven't just ripped it up from day one. Kemal Roach struggling here at the Oval, for example.
It was
very flat, but still, you know, it's quite nice seeing, like, some county players who want that experience. Sam Evans getting his first county championship 100, for example, against an attack with Keemo Roach in it is a good thing. Ben, one player I listed out, Adam Lai, it's been a long time since he played for England, but he's really come out of the blocks far in the start of the season.
Yeah, well, 380 in two games, and you start sort of twitching, thinking, is 1,000 runs before the end of May possible?
I wondered when the Claxton was going to go for the 1,000 runs.
Yeah, and I've gone early.
Were you born the last time somebody did that? Jeff?
Don't think so.
No, let's start on that Buckley thing I've heard about. I can't have that.
That would have been Hick, wouldn't it? Which is what, in the 90s? Mm. In the 80s,
88.
Sorry. In the 88.
88. Yeah. So, just before your time.
Well, 6 years before my time, yeah. Lyth is genuinely an interesting one because it's very easy to group all those English openers that were tried in Test cricket together. But actually, if you look back, I don't think you could say he was harshly treated because he couldn't get a run in that Ashes series. And he then didn't go and tear up county cricket afterwards. But firstly, a lot of players who, you know, struggled to score runs in an Ashes series in England, where, you know, you have players at their peak, brilliant quicks, open bowling, you know, he scored more runs in that series, I think, than David Warner scored in 2019. And no one's questioning David Warner's pedigree as a Test batsman. And Adam Lai, there was reason to believe he was possibly the most talented of all of those. I think Andrew Gale once said that he was more talented than Root and Bairstow, which is a...
Bold.
What'd you say?
Bold.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And they got that 100 against New Zealand against a properly like high class attack, you know, Bolt and Southee. That is 100 that should make you not write a player altogether. You know, he's 35 now, so he is getting on, which means it's kind of now or never. If he continues on this form, then England are going to have like a real hard time sort of saying no to him.
They'll say no.
Yeah, it's gone now. But a good player and maybe a victim of. Bit too soon, possibly, you know, a big Ashes series at home, swinging ball, a decent attack, obviously. And he's always struck me as perhaps the most naturally talented of the Southpaw openers who were given a go, you know, in that kind of post-Strauss era. Butch?
I think he's a good player, yeah, no doubt. Funnily enough, I think that he's more loose than you would like an opening batsman to be. Mm-hmm. You know, you think of somebody like Marcus Trescothick, who obviously played his shots at the top of the order. However, he was in a box, wasn't he? You could put him in an alleyway and he would play straight and wait for the ball to be wide. Lyth has had far too much of a tendency to sort of be going after huge drives of balls on the up, and you'd be thinking, well, I'm setting three gullies, backward point, two slips and hang it out there, and that's what's going to happen. And I think, I mean, I hope he doesn't mind me saying, we had a chat actually. I spoke to him about some drills, not necessarily about leaving the ball, but some drills to kind of like to not hit so many skimmers in the sort of in the gully point region, you know. And you know, something that he may or may not have taken on board, I don't know. But I just remember thinking at the time, being really sort of positive about what I thought, how good a player I thought he was, but what I thought, if he could just tweak this little thing, don't lose any of the natural flair or the whatever, he would make himself less easy to dismiss or sort of less likely to give his wicket away. But unfortunately, you know, he, like I said, he went back to Yorkshire and kind of then didn't tear it up, you know, didn't go back and say, well, I'm too good at this level, I should be back there. And unfortunately, in the interim time, his chance has gone.
Mm. But... I don't know. I mean, a lot would have to happen, but you have seen players get a first go at Test cricket at a younger age, come back at this sort of age, and then have, like, you could still have two or three
35?
Years.
35?
Well, Chris Rogers, what age would he have been when he came back in? You can have two or three 30, years as a 32? Top-class batsman at this sort of age. I mean, it's. I don't think it's completely out of the question.
Listen, you're protesting very well, but I'm just saying it's not going to happen.
Yeah, fine. I think...
I'm not saying that the only reason that he shouldn't be picked is that he's too old, but it really isn't helping him. It's not helping him at all.
We've added 2 years. He's 33.
Okay.
The point does still stand, I think. I think it was one hell of a punt to imagine him making a second come in here. But
I think there are spots open, and I think that, well, I mean, not that he has as good a chance as anyone. That's not true. But if he does put together an unanswerable case, I don't think England can just completely.
No,
I mean, what you think?
Rolls along so fast,
what you're thinking is that if you're going to pick a little bit like Michael Carberry was picked for the Ashes trip, right? Carb's never played a Test match at home. Now you're talking about talented opening batsmen. I mean, he, you know, serious player, serious player. You know, had the wrong end of Mitchell Johnson and co on that, you know, that ill-fated Ashes trip, and didn't disgrace himself by any means whatsoever, and never played again. If you're going to take somebody of that sort of experience on an Ashes trip, because that's basically what you're saying, we'll take somebody that's got the experience, battle hardened, to go out there and score runs in a, you know, top of the order in an Ashes series, and hopefully bring us back the Ashes. Is Adam Lyde that guy? Are they going to make that, given the things I've just said about the way that he plays, and given the sort of the dangers of that on bouncy tracks in Australia? I don't think the case is compelling, and so, you know, he may well make 1,000 runs before May, but I doubt very much we'll see him playing for England this winter.
Yeah, that's fair. I think the last thing I'd say is, if there was ever a time to pick someone just for an 8 month or a 12 month stint in the Test side, it would be now, because England have like about as hard a 12 months. I mean, even excluding the injuries, you can kind of imagine them having the two best sides in the world this summer, and then away in Australia in the winter.
Phil, the game of the round was at Chelmsford. Essex, Durham. Essex bowled out for 96 in the opening day and ended up still winning it. You were there for a lot of it. Yep. Decent game of cricket.
Yeah, a belter. And it's now coming up to 1,000 days since they've been beaten in a four-dayer at Chelmsford, which speaks for itself. And, you know, it's a cliche, but winning begets winning. And I was in the box at one point, and Keith Fletcher, who's dressed these days like an extra out of Detectorists, he looks absolutely marvellous. He's in the back of the box with his packed lunch and his Deerstalker hat, and he said, we'll win this. I think this was end of day two, or heading towards the end of day two. Yeah. And there was that sense throughout. I spoke to Tom Wesley actually this morning, and he says once the wheel started to turn in the game, you sensed that there was this sort of unstoppable momentum, you know, and with Harmer, obviously, who just took another routine tenfer just like that. They turned that one around. At one point, I think Durham were ahead on first innings, one wicket down. So to win it from that position statistically is very, very rare. But there is an air of inevitability around them. And, you know, little bits to take from it. They have a seam bowling attack, all homegrown, that do the job. None of them are express quick. You know, if you're a first team club cricketer, you wouldn't be particularly concerned getting out there, and yet they do the job week after week. Sam Cook averages next to nothing for his 3 years as a new ball bowler. Demands that you play time after time after time. I mean, he's carved from the great sort of Mount Rushmore seamers of English cricket, you know, that you don't suppose they're going to really scratch the surface of a test cap, but that doesn't really matter. You know, they do an extraordinary job for their counties week after week. Jamie Porter's another one. I watched Harmer on the final day and the Saturday evening, and what strikes me, and look, I'm no expert of spin bowling to say the least, right? Not only does he have the biggest hands in England, and I include Ricky Clark in that, right? They are monstrous plates. But there is no discernible change in his action, and yet the ball is either skidding on and hitting your back leg when you're neither one thing nor the other, or it's looping there and it's never quite getting there. But there is no discernible change. There's no change in arm speed or the torque in the action or the pivot. It's entirely identical, and yet you have no idea what's coming out from one to the other. And once he gets on a roll, he's unstoppable. And as he said to me in that kind of blunt, kind of nice, or rather appealing South African way, he says, the thing with English players, they either try and hit me for six or they defend for their lives, and then I'll get them out. And he said that to me 2 years ago. He said, with the exception of James Vince and Gary Balance, he says they're the only two players in English cricket that he doesn't think he's going to get out any minute now.
Yeah, worth mentioning Scott Borthwick's 100 of that game, 100 of the first 148. Yes. And also in the Essex second innings, it wasn't just Dan Lawrence, who we will talk about later in the show, but Paul Walter got 77, and then some low order resistance from Ben Allison and Sam Cook. Without that partnership, they probably don't win that game.
Tall Paul, they call him.
Yeah, 6'7", former opening bowler.
House DJ. Yeah, so yeah, he's 6'7" or 6'8", and he bats 5. I mean, sum up the eccentricities of county cricket right there. I mean, he should be a doorman. He shouldn't be a cricketer. He began as a bowling all-rounder.
They have a record of that, though, don't they? Well,
yeah.
Will Jefferson was at Essex, first of all, wasn't he?
Yeah, something in the watermark, I think, down there.
Proper big un.
Yeah. You're but a bowler turned batsman, Phil, from Essex.
Indeed. All right. but he played very responsibly, you know, and he got in behind it and kind of stonewalled it for a couple of hours, and then it expanded a bit. It was just one of those get the job done type third innings, really. You know, no one really stood out.
I can tell you something about that. If you're playing in a team whereby you know that if you get a team behind, even if it's only 150, come the fourth innings of a match, it doesn't half make batting a lot easier, even if you've stuffed it up in the first innings.
Yeah.
I remember winning a game against Hampshire at Guildford of all places. They bowled us out for nothing in our first inning, second innings of the game, and we were in the dressing room going, go on, please make us follow on. Because we knew they wouldn't bowl us out again. We just, you know, we'd had an absolute shocker. Just nicked everything and kind of hadn't played very well. Sure enough, the knock comes on the door, we want you to bat again, and we all just looked at each other and went, right, okay. Got 450 and bowled them out in the last sack lane and saw bowled them out in the last inning. When you know...
That is a shocking call. With those two spinners in your team, that is a...
When you know that you have a bowling attack that can take wickets on anything, or the batters just know that all you have to do is give them a chance.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it makes that 2 hour 50 or whatever it is, it makes it worthwhile. It's not something you think, well, I'm just wasting my time here. You know, no, what we're doing, absolutely fine. We'll take as long as it takes to get us back in the game, to get our noses back in front again. Harmer, Porter and Coe will bowl them out. And the other thing I love about Harmer, There's a righteous indignation about him every time he takes a wicket. You know what I mean? It's like it's as though he spends his life opening fan mail or non-fan mail with people saying, you can't bowl, you're rubbish.
Yeah.
Because every time he gets a wicket, every time they get a win, he's like furious with the world. Like, yeah, I told you, I showed you lot.
That's a good shout.
And it's good fun to watch. It really is. With his shirt hanging out, looking like, you know, they do look like a club team, Essex, by the way.
Yeah, they do.
They look like they've rolled out.
Don't play like one.
They're all stubbing.
They drink like one.
Stubbing their fags out on the boundary as they walk over the line, you know. But they're brilliant.
I can either confirm or deny what you just said. By the way.
Now, that was a metaphor, but if that is actually happening, then all good.
Just a brief word on Durham. Good seam attack, from what I saw. Bryden Cass is a good bowler.
Quick, isn't he?
You know, the Lions have looked at him. He's 6 foot. Plenty again, South African born, really good repeatable action, high action, and wangs it down there. He took a good five for in the second innings, and also hurt his ankle, but picked himself up and went again. I think he had a runner on the final day, so it wasn't just a little sprain; it was significant. But yeah, he showed a bit of ticker as well. I think they'll be kicking themselves because they had two opportunities to win these first two games, and as it is, they've drawn one and lost one now. But yeah, it was impressive. Impressive. Good to see.
Knott's winless run in first class cricket extended this week. They lost an amazing game against Warwickshire. Warwickshire without Dom Sibley for 95% of the game, basically, after he got his finger injured. They chased 333 on the final day against a Knott's attack led by Stuart Broad. Tim Bresnan top scored in the fourth innings with 68 not out. Runs for Sam Hain, Matt Lamb and Ollie Stone too. Hampshire made it two wins from two as well. The highlight from that game was Mohammed Abbas's hat-trick in the first innings. Figures of 6 for 11 from 11 overs, which are pretty handy. Hundreds for Ian.
Took him 17 balls to get his 5 for in that innings. Which they,
17 and a hat-trick was the first 3 wickets as well. So,
And I think after about 4 overs, he still had more wickets taken than runs conceded. So he was a crazy spell.
Ben, what's your moment of the week?
Well, my moment of the week is Ollie Pope making a lovely double hundred and a lovely blue headband out of the Oval. I mean, it's no great surprise to see him tearing up a modest-ish county attack on a flat, slow wicket. But it was sort of heartening to see because he's not had the easiest time recently. He's struggled a bit in India and struggled a bit in the bubble in general as well. He spoke nicely after the sort of elatedly a little bit, tired and elatedly after the. After the double, sort of said that, it's very nice being able to just walk into the ground and get a coffee, and you miss that when you're not in the bubble. It's like the small things as well as the big things. He also said that he thanked the headband for getting him to his double. He said that when he got out, he slept in the 90s overnight against West Indies last summer, and the next morning didn't wear a headband, having worn it the previous day, and then got out before reaching his 100. So today there was no way he wasn't going to wear his headband, having gone to sleep again in the 90s, went on to make 200 and plenty.
Okay.
Yeah. But whatever gets you through the game, I suppose.
But no, it was a lovely knock, lovely partnership between him and Jamie Smith, who are two young players. You both bat aggressively, but not too much, and kind of look just very, very ease at this level, and only too good for it, really. He now averages just under 75 for Surrey, which is extraordinary. And for all this, that he's, you know, not quite cracked Test cricket fully yet, is like a hugely talented player.
He
like
will.
Exactly. I got a bit of sympathy for him in the winter as well. I mean, he got done twice in that questionable Test match with the silly pink ball or whatever it is. And he was done by a couple of Ashwin shooters that's, you know, almost taking pace from the pitch and so on. And he was just starting to figure it out, I thought, in the final Test, and played nicely in that first innings for 30 or 40 odd, and then got a harshly done, really, caught off the back leg and looped a short leg through his legs, kind of Chinese shot, you know, and I felt for him a bit, really. There is no question that he's going to score thousands and thousands of Test match runs, right?
A quick word on Hassan Azad at Leicester. He scored an unbeaten 144 on the last day to score a draw for Leicester. He averages over 50 in the county championship for Leicester over three seasons now. And I know it was a very slow pitch, wickets were hard to come by, but I thought he looked really, really good. Played Kemal Roach well. Roach kind of got better as the game went on. And also, he's one of those players who is a very low strike rate, very watchful, but he can play as well. He's got really nice cover drive, but really leans into it. And I guess he's one of the players we're talking about, Phil, as someone who might have agitated for a move if in a two division system, but in a conference system, there's no need.
Listen, the other thing about all of this is cricket is one of those games where sometimes you're only as good as the people you're playing against. You know, if you are an opening batsman who leaves the ball outside off stump, who's, you know, technically proficient, doesn't go out there looking to dominate and smash the ball all over the place. If you never come up against an attack where those sort of skills are of any use to you, i.e. you're supposed to be out there climbing into everything, how do you ever know if you're good at being an opener? All of it, you go out there and play against the Ambrose and Walsh or whatever it might be, and all of a sudden those skills are damn important, and you can find out whether you can do the job or not, right? And so, again, somebody like him is now going to have the chance to prove himself in front of proper opening bowling attacks, which, again, you know, I'm not being disparaging at what he might face in Division 2 over the last couple of seasons. I'm not. All I'm saying is you're going to have the variety now to be able to prove whether you can play in the style that the bowling that you're facing warrants.
Yeah.
And by the looks of it, he can.
I mean, objectively, he's just facing more international bowlers than you would in Division 2.
There you have it. There you have it. And that's in cricket, is a game like that. You know, I mean, somebody like, it's funny, Martin Bicknell was always a great example. Somebody that got people out for fun on flat decks here at the Oval, you know, proper players, proper opening bats. He'd go back to club cricket for Guildford and they would just get, you know, just slog him into the road. They just would play with no respect whatsoever. So it works both ways, you know. The levels sometimes you need to be playing at a level above where you've been in order to show that you're any good.
Yeah.
That's what I've been telling myself.
Yeah. That's it. I mean, it'll work for Phil, for sure.
Just a word on Azad.
Yes.
A shortish interview, but a revealing and very stylishly constructed interview, actually, in the upcoming magazine by Joe Whiteley, who's a freelancer, and he's very good, actually. And it was just a piece with Azad, who documented his ongoing struggles with mental health.
Mm-hmm.
And first detected that things weren't quite right when he was 15-year-old, growing up in Pakistan. He came over soon after that. Fast forward the story 10 years, he was at Loughborough University and feeling as low as you can get, really, and he says that himself. And yet he went for a trial at Leicester around that time. And he says himself he was crying. He was crying in the nets, full-on crying in the nets. He says it mattered not one whit what happened from one ball to the next. He says he wasn't present there. It was right in the midst of it. He says it was 2 days after an episode that he didn't have to elaborate upon. But in the midst of all of that, and he says there are large chunks that are just missing from those years. So he doesn't personally remember, but he played very well.
Mm.
And they kept an eye on him. And then fast forward a few more months and they were prepared to offer him a contract for the following year. And he's gone from there. He averages comfortably in the 40s, I think, as an opening bat. I mean, anyone to do that, county cricket, is a good player. And it's an interesting story. And it was very eloquently told and honestly told, I think. And of course, it taps into a very real and present issue for everybody. But county cricket has its own challenges when it comes to issues of mental health as well. And for him to speak so openly and respectfully on that subject was quite moving, actually.
And
it was a really, really recommended piece, actually.
I spoke to him a couple of years ago. He's a lovely guy, but also quite interesting story. I mean, when he played cricket in Pakistan, he was actually in the same Pakistan under 15 side as Babar Azam,
right,
who was his captain, which is a handy teammate to have. And also, he said that he was part of the Loughborough University Quidditch team when he was
another Quidditcher.
As well. Who else is there?
I'm sure.
Tom Wesley.
Tom Wesley's done a whole module on Harry Potter at university.
Yeah. Yes.
There is another Quidditcher, though, in county cricket. Look, let's just move on. whatever happened to a game of snooker on a Friday night?
And quickly, Phil, your moment of the week is from that Surrey-Leicester game.
Yeah, look, terribly mawkish and sentimental. But I did an hour's chatting commentary with Mark Church up in the box at the Oval as the game meandered along in the background. And we chatted about nothing of great consequence whatsoever. And it was just nice. It was nice to do so with an old pal. Admittedly, there's a big Perspex partition, but it was lovely. And the game was playing out as we spoke, and we chatted about the all-time greatest Surrey 11, which was in the magazine that I gave him at the time, which compiled by your dad, Mark, and spoke about, you know, the Laker lock enmity and Ram Prakash's freakish stats for Surrey and what it would have been like to bowl to the master, Hobbs, as well. And we just sort of like ambled through a nice pub conversation with a game of cricket going on in the background. And I just thought, yeah, we might have a chance this year.
I enjoyed...
It was a nice thing.
I enjoyed the moment where you saw yourself on the big screen.
Oh, yeah.
With a camera right in your face.
Big brother is watching you.
That was controlled by John Surtees. Entertaining. My moment of the week is the Matt Parkinson ball of the 21st century. If you've not seen it and you think that's an exaggeration, watch it and you'll agree with me. It's genuinely eerily similar to the Warne to Gatting delivery. It pitches miles outside leg stump and ends up hitting the top of off. Ben, you're speaking to him very soon, so I guess we'll hear all about it possibly on next week's show. That was an amazing delivery. Some news from outside the first class game this week. India has been placed on the UK travel red list this week. Yes. Ali Martin, in his report in The Guardian, writes, elite sports people and support staff have an exemption that allows them to travel to the UK from an otherwise banned red list country. However, that still requires a 10-day stay in a government-approved quarantine hotel upon arrival, with no special dispensation to leave for training or to compete. The question now is to how this affects the England and New Zealand cricketers who are currently in the IPL and intend to fly in for the two-match test series that starts at Lords on June the 2nd, as well as India's arrival for the World Test Championship final against New Zealand in Southampton later that month. So we'll see how that story develops. And in South Africa, the seemingly never-ending CSA drama rumbles on. In a report on ESPN Cricket Info, Fadus Munda writes, South Africa's cricketers have apologised to sponsors and fans for the administrative upheaval that has led to the ministerial intervention into cricket South Africa. The national captains, Dean Elgar, Themba Bavuma and Dane van Niekerk, along with the South Africa Cricketers Association, have signed a statement urging that the issues be resolved as quickly as possible. There is a threat of suspension from both the government and the ICC. More positively, Phil, there's a new magazine out this week. What's in it?
Ta-da! Daniel Lawrence.
Yeah.
I went down the day before the season began to speak to him at Chelmsford, a socially distanced, obviously.
Of course.
Halfway through the chat, Tom Wesley turned up, so we had a good sort of three-way conversation. That sort of made the article for me. He did all my research by having played with him every day for the last 4 or 5 years. And Lawrence, look, he's obviously a fascinating batsman, endlessly watchable, with a slight kind of air of danger. I think, you know, it could all go spectacularly wrong at any point, and yet he also bats time as well. So he's a peculiar combination, you know. He's not a dasher, he's not a blocker, he's somewhere in between. I guess that amounts to a good player. But he's the way that he carries himself as well, you know, he's... You can't fake that kind of confidence. And I've interviewed 1,000 cricketers, and Mark's played with 1,000 cricketers. When you know that they're faking, you know that it's a bit of bluff, because it's a game riddled with self-doubt, as we all know. There is no self-doubt with this kid. I asked him about the Australia Lions trip when he averaged 98 across all the formats. I said, were you surprised by how well you went? He said, no, not really. He said, you know, good tracks, I'd expect to get big runs. And he doesn't say that from a peacock-like perspective, you know. He says it because that's how he sees it. And this is what I've heard about him since he was a 16-year-old. John Childs said to me, you can't fake that kind of confidence. One of the questions is whether he can marry all of that ability and confidence with the churn, the weekly churn, you know. And it was interesting that Wesley said at one point, do you remember, this is a quote, do you remember, Dan, when we were at Derby 2 or 3 years ago and you got to 80 and you got caught in the boundary after they put the field out? And then a week later against Treadwell, he hit him for 6 to get to 70 or 80 odd against Kent at Canterbury and did the same thing, caught in the boundary. And Lauren and Wesley said, I don't see that happening now. I see, you know, you got greedy, the penny's dropped. Well, 2 or 3 days ago, Lawrence played beautifully for 76. And what did he do, Mark?
Well, I'm
he was caught deep square. Yeah. He was caught deep square after they put the man back. He absolutely lacerated a pull shot, but even so, the trap was set and he fell for it. Now, this is interesting with him because he has all of this ability. Can he marry it up with the, you know, the smarts or the streetwiseness that you need in order to really crack it at the top level? I have a lot of hope and a lot of optimism that he will do. And if he does do, it's a great unusual development in English cricket because he comes from the backwoods of East London. He doesn't come through the straightforward public school system, which increasingly is how English cricketers emerge at the top level. And so if it were to happen, then I think it's a great thing for the English game. And I just truly hope that it does because he's one hell of a character.
Mm. But listen to that. Do you think there is almost a danger when a young player has that much confidence when they come into international cricket? Or do you think that is a good thing?
No, I think it's a great thing. I mean, look, the 70 he scored in his first test match innings in Sri Lanka was a really good knock. You know, Turner, Gull, just a regular Turner in Gull, you know, not something where there were bits of pitch flying up into your eyes every time the ball landed. And many an England player, myself included, would not have been able to do that their first outing in an England shirt. And he played quite beautifully. Found life a little bit tougher in India, as everybody did. I think the difficulty at the minute is finding where he fits in and where he might fit in at the moment. With Stokes at 5 and Pope at 6, potentially at 3, I suppose you could make that argument. I wouldn't, but well, whatever. So there isn't a sort of a gaping hole anyway in England's middle order that you'd say, right, Dan Lawrence, that's your spot. But he showed enough to sort of be on the very, very short list should loss of form or fitness or whatever afflict any of the guys in that middle order. And fair play to him. You know, I suppose the other thing is what happens. Does he find a way in post this T20 World Cup? Does he find a way in of making a case for himself in the next World Cup, 50 over World Cup cycle?
I asked him
That's an interesting one because, you know, Morgan probably won't make it to that World Cup. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be a spot in the middle order there for somebody that can, you know, he bowls a little bit of filthy stuff, can smack it out the park, good field, all of those things. Yep. So, you know, he's another player that could think to himself, well, hang on, here's my route in here.
We don't need to go down this road, but I did ask him that and he said, well, when am I next going to play a 50 over game? He's with London Spirit this summer.
Yeah, we talked about this before on the podcast. When are Pope, Crawley and Lawrence going to play?
Don't get me started.
What else is in the magazine?
Well, we have introduced a new dedicated county section where we run 18 stories a month, basically.
Which that Azad story is part of.
Which Azad is part of. It's swallowed up much of the magazine. So if county cricket isn't your thing, then maybe go and buy a contemporary tractor or something. Let's do it on W.A. Smith's, which is actually quite a good magazine. Yeah, we thought now more than ever, we've got to nail our colours to that mast. You know, we believe in the model as it is. We believe that county cricket is still the bedrock of the game. And you've got to nurture it and protect it for all its worth. And So we're trying to reflect that a little bit more this summer, I think. And there are stories that emerge from county cricket that you don't always necessarily get a handle on, you know. And national coverage has been squeezed of county cricket, as we well know. So we're trying to do that, really.
Yeah, and it's 18 fleshed out stories. It's not just, you know, they're not.
Yeah, they're not nibs. They're not news in briefy things. They're all hopefully relatively substantial pieces. Mm.
Well, you can head to wisden.com/shop to get yourselves a copy.
Also, I just want to bring Buckley in. He did write something rather beautiful, actually, about Anderson's final spell at Trent Bridge, 2013,
yeah.
Yeah.
When he bowled forever and ever and ever as England won one of the classic Ashes test matches that's almost been forgotten.
That was the test match, wasn't it? Where Broad was a bleep bloke, but Brad Haddin nicked the final wicket to the wicketkeeper and stood there. yeah, that's right. And everyone, and England went utterly berserk at the end. Great test match.
Yeah, yeah. Why did you choose that spell?
Was it as good a piece of writing as Lover, You Should Have Come Over?
I'll answer Yaz's question. So I mean, firstly, it kind of sums up what I like about James Anderson, which is the kind of how hard he's had to work for it all, rather than how good he is when everything is in his favour. Like, I've always liked seeing him sort of plough his furrow when it's been really hard going and he's had to really struggle to keep the runs down and, like, you know, get a fortuitous wicket here and there, and he just bowled brilliant. It was also sort of from a personal point of view, my brother moved back home because of a bereavement, so we kind of were updating each other on the test match as it was going on, and that last day we kind of watched the whole day because it was you know, the kind of morning that began. It could have all been over in half an hour, or it could have been a real classic, and it was the latter. And then Anderson, he bowled, because it wasn't just that he bowled sort of 12 overs on the bounce, it was that he didn't take a wicket until his 7th or 8th over. And then starts taking from there. So you're thinking, like, if he's not taking wicket, you've got to, you know, give someone else a go, because England didn't have a huge amount of runs to play with. But he just would not let go of the ball. And then when he did, Finn and Swan, I think, both got a bit of tap. And so he then had to come back again before lunch and then just after lunch to finally get that wicket. And the final moment is a great one, as Mark says, because it's sort of the best, one of the best instances of DRS adding to the drama, because it wasn't like a clear-cut thing that there was like a definite spike or a definite noise. So England was sort of waiting for that moment to come on the big screen. And so when it did, there was like a proper, like a genuine joyful reaction that just added to everything.
It also fed that photo. I think it's Phil Brown, although it may not be, when they're all together. Obviously, they're in the huddle waiting for the decision. And so you get that marvellous shot where it's only the 11 players together. Euphoric.
I think listeners might find it quite interesting that you got into cricket quite late for someone who works in cricket,
yeah,
and that was one of your earlier
2011 was the first summer that I properly absorbed everything of, so yeah, that, I guess that was the first almost proper Ashes series, so yeah, it was like a bit of build up. And then it was because it was a weird test match, but it was a really good one. You know, you had
been retired 2 years.
I was thinking I was already a weathered hack by 2011.
Yeah.
Anyway, this is a theme developing here.
Yes. The IPL, as we mentioned in the last few shows, across the IPL, we've partnered with Who Knows Wins, a social sports game where mates, families and colleagues pit their wits for real money and bragging rights. In week two, last week, Phil and Joe are tied on 5 points with 3 rounds to go, 2 points behind the current leader at the moment, in with a sniff of claiming the pot. Ben and I aren't doing great. Week three,
if we do win, it goes to charity.
Yes,
incidentally.
Yes, yeah,
a bit of chance to shine action.
Absolutely. And week three of the IPL by Wisden League begins on Friday this week.
It is really good fun.
It is good fun. It is good fun.
Stuck in.
And this week the league is purely asking you to pick the winner of the games from Friday through to the following Thursday. To take part in the league, download Who Knows Wins in the App Store and head to the cricket section for your chance to win the pot this week. The more people in the league, the bigger the pot. Phil, you're audaciously going for Mumbai to beat Punjab on Friday.
I mean, shock horror. serial winners against a team that invariably doesn't really get very far. That's my obvious pick. So that's the Friday game, Mumbai to beat Punjab. Punjab got a lot of batsmen but basically no bowlers and can give up anything.
Jai Richardson at 7 as well,
so, yeah. They've posted so far 106 for 8 and 220 for 2 or something like that, so they're that kind of team. And Mumbai, they don't muck about, as we know. But the more interesting, or the slightly less uninteresting statement is KKR to beat Rajasthan the day after on the Saturday, and I've actually done my research on this. Do you want me to do it?
Yeah, go for it.
KKR have won four of the last five against Rajasthan. Rajasthan, obviously, without Jofra, without Stokes, light with the ball. And Rajasthan have been woefully unreliable again, as they were last year. Even the game that they won, they're 2-1, two defeats, one win so far. Even the one that they won, six of the top seven batsmen didn't even get to double figures. And the game that they almost won, the game I mentioned earlier, the 220 versus 217 game against Punjab, it was a Samson one-man show. So their batsmen, and I include Butler in that, their batsmen aren't quite really clicking yet. And with obviously without Jofra, you'd say that they're there for the taking. So Rajasthan to get beat by KKR and Mumbai to trample on Punjab. There you go.
I think it was when we were recording last week's show, Ben Stokes had ruled out of the rest of the IPL. So that's a big blow to Rajasthan. He was also missing the England-New Zealand Test Series.
That's confirmed, right? So he's surgery, is that right?
Yes, Stokes? 12 weeks. So
12 weeks?
Yeah, serious injury.
Lawrence is well in at five.
Ben, at the time of recording, RCB are 3 from 3. You've been reasonably positive about their chances this season, and it's fair to say they've possibly surpassed your expectations. Harshal Patel's done very well. They even opted against using 4 overseas slots in their most recent game, which is a bit of an alpha move.
Yeah, well, especially for them, it's a hell of a statement, really, because they have been the team more than any other that sort of banked on a few big name overseas players and then just like not really caring who else they pick, and that has not worked for them.
Kohli's not even in Nick.
Yeah, true. Yeah, and so for them to go against to not pick one of their use one of their 4 slots is quite a significant move in a way. I sort of back them, but with caveats, saying that quite a lot needs to go right. But if it does, they've got a proper side, and it kind of everything has gone right. Glenn Maxwell is in some of the best IPL form he's ever been in. Siraj looks like he's come back from the Australia tour just as like a properly good bowler in all formats now, which he wasn't always the most consistent in the IPL. Harshal Patel, yeah, a real fine. And AB de Villiers is just an absolute freak, isn't he? I mean, that was an amazing innings yesterday, and also just felt completely inevitable, basically, that he was going to, like, that every ball was going to go to the boundary, and it was a surprise when it didn't. So yeah, obviously nothing new, so he's an unbelievable player, but he's still sort of however old he is and just completely churning it out.
Led you to looking up some AB de Villiers stats, and you found one amazing one, which all 25 of his ODI hundreds had a strike rate of 100 or more, which is just absurd.
He's a player.
Yeah, he's not bad, is he? 37 and still doing the business. There have been a couple of remarkable low-scoring games, actually. A couple involving Sunrisers Hyderabad. Against RCB, they were chasing 150 and were 96 for 1 after 13 overs and ended up falling 6 short. Against Mumbai, they were chasing 151, were 67 for none after 7.1 overs. Bairstow scoring 43 off 22. And they could only make 137 in the end. Rahul Chahar continuing his excellent starts the competition with a cheap threefer. Butch, if 2 middle-order collapses in a row... when that happens once, is that kind of infectious in a team? When they, especially for a side that historically has relied a lot on their openers doing the business,
it can be for sure. Particularly when you look at Sunrisers Hyderabad's middle order, it's full of inexperienced Indian players. So yeah, I mean that can certainly happen. Their captain Warner was quite upset, I think, at losing the one against Mumbai, and let everybody know that in the post-match interviews. So, listen, I mean, they've got a pretty easy fix, haven't they? They'll have to leave out probably Mujeeb, I would think, to get Kane Williamson in, and then you know you can replace one of the youngsters in the middle order with somebody like Kedar Yadav, experienced player, bowls a bit of off-spin, you know, so can make up perhaps for the overs that they're losing Mujeeb, but also then you put in one of the goats in the middle order in Williamson, and that should sort things out for them. But you know, the issue is that losing begets losing in the same way as winning begets winning. So they'll hope they need to make good on that. Is they part of the doubleheader tomorrow, aren't they? Against Punjab. So I mean, that's a great good team to be playing when you're three from three.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they blow very, very, very cold to sometimes hot themselves. So that should be a great game in the doubleheader tomorrow.
Delhi, last year's runners-up, are two from three at the time recording. Shikhar Dhawan has been very, very good, and he has been for a long time in the IPL. Prithvi Shaw's found form, as we mentioned last week. Ben, from an English perspective, I know we talked about Chris Wokes on last week's show. He's done very well in the power play, not so well at the death, which is what he's done before. But he's barely played T20 cricket in the last few years. You wrote a really good piece about how his case with England is might not have been aided by how he talks about himself in the media, which is quite interesting. Do you want to explain that? And yeah, quite interesting to hear what Butch thinks about that as well.
Well, I kind of got the impression that he didn't hugely talk himself up, but I was surprised going back and looking through what he'd said, just how much he kind of talked himself down. Like, it was in March last year, so when we still thought the T20 World Cup was going to be that year, that he kind of said, you know, England know what I can do and it's going to take absolutely loads of injuries for me to be in with a shout. And then in December last year, he was talking about the T20 team entirely in the third person, sort of saying like, yeah, they're doing really good stuff, a bit like we were doing in the ODI World Cup. And it's like, there's no reason why you couldn't be in the mix for this team. And I know he hasn't played a lot of T20 cricket, but just like, he's a very skillful player who can do lots of things. And there's no reason why T20 cricket couldn't be one of them. The one thing I would say about his IPL performance is he's developed sort of like a split fingered slower ball that he holds. So with his fingers a bit wider, that means that it's basically the exact same action, but comes out a little bit slower, which must make it hard to pick. But the question I was wondering for you, Butch, is how much do you think actually how a player sort of talks about themselves and how they're talked about in the media, does that actually affect selection much at all? Or do you think England will go into it sort of with like discarding basically everything they've read and just going on what they can see themselves?
Yeah, but I think it can only harm you as an individual if you're not particularly vociferous in backing up your own ability in the press. I'm not too sure about what the press writes makes it a huge amount of difference. I mean, sometimes, believe it or not, the media just tell the truth of what they see, and they're right. You know, that does happen, doesn't it?
Well,
it does happen, yeah. So, you know, and if and any player worth his or her salt will ignore that and try to put things right. We'll be honest with themselves to know that yes, there's an issue that needs addressing. Address it and get on with it, you know, and ignore it. But
when you've been captaining teams and involved in management level and all of that, senior players, do you sometimes though find it hard to deal with certain characters who are? Let me rephrase that. Right, are there certain players who require more management and possibly end up playing a little bit more than they should, or being given a longer leash than they should because they are high maintenance characters? And that the flip side also applies?
I think, okay, so I've come across some difficult characters and guys actually who you wish to spend a little bit more time on but can't because the other fellas are taking up all of your bandwidth. Mm. Now, in a county dressing room, very different from an international one, You can afford to look at it in such a way as, right, okay, what returns are we as a team getting from this difficult character? If his difficulty is allied with match-winning performances and generally being very, very good, then you have to put up with it, and you put other people, you know, you give people, it's your week this week, you look after him or whatever it might be. If, on the other hand, somebody is a potentially very, very good, but is also a massive pain in the backside and is kind of keeping the team or yourself as a captain from being able to spend time on people that perhaps need the assistance more, then you move them out of the way.
I've always been interested by this. There's a sort of slight moral equivalence in cricket, and there is in life, obviously. But I remember around the Peterson thing, you know, was he still so good that we could indulge it?
That's why that's why I made the caveat about a county dressing room. Very different for England. Right. England is not a club team. England's not a village side where you're playing with your mates and you want everything to be nice and can't, you know, everyone being friendly and having a beer out with each other. Sure. England's different.
Yeah.
If somebody is a whopping great big pain in the arse but is also one of the best players in the world, you have to think very, very carefully about whether you're going to be harming your team's chances of being a winning side or not by leaving him out.
Yeah.
And at the time with Kevin Peterson, England harmed them. You know, the fallout from that 2014 Ashes series with Peterson and Cook and all the rest of it lasted forever.
Yeah.
There are a lot of players we've mentioned in this in this podcast, actually. You know, batsmen who fell by the wayside, careers of people like Ian Bell, etc., who were all harmed by the by that Peterson farrago. And one of the things that, okay, I never shared a dressing room with Kev, so I have nothing to say on that. You know, you hear what you hear, you make up your own mind. But all I know is this, from watching it from the outside, Kevin Peterson made a lot of those players better than they were. You know, having the opposition worried about the bloke at the other end and not worried about you was very, very handy for the likes of Ian Bell and Jonathan Trott and guys like that. No doubt. I guarantee you, knew what it was like playing with top players, batting with somebody like Graham Thorpe or whatever it might have been. Or seeing how, you know, a young Australian batsman came along with Ponting, etc. at the other end. You have guys like that in your team. It is wonderful for the rest of the batting lineup. Make no mistake. And so, I'm with you. I know what you're going to say. You'll be very much of the opinion that Kevin Peterson should have been in that side. I don't give a stuff what he did, who he texted, what his problem was. He was too good not to be in that team. And I agree with you.
Do you think there's a chance, I guess this is relevant to the current Alex Hales discussion, that if you have someone who doesn't quite fit in for whatever reason, who might have done things that the team didn't like in the past, that can impact the performances of the other players negatively?
If they're in the team, yeah. I think we're getting to the point whereby there may be a detente on Alex Hales. But don't forget, Alex Hales was not Kevin Peterson. Alex Hales was not undroppable. Alex Hales was not the greatest player that England have ever had when he did what he did in Bristol when he then failed a drugs test. So again, the goalposts are in slightly different places. Now you could say Alex Hales is a terrific player. Why is he not in the England's 2020 side? And you know, any problems, given exactly what I've just said about Kevin Peterson, any problems they have, they should overlook, because it's more important that England win the 2020 World Cup. The issue is that Alex Hales when he got left out of the side, was not somebody that was undroppable at the time. Wasn't the greatest player that England have ever had at the time.
And he still has to prove
to everybody, if he gets a second chance, which I'm sure he will do at some point. Because if he lets them down again, he's gone forever and ever. I mean, he's almost unbelievably lucky to get a chance this time, given that we were 2-3 months away from a World Cup that England had spent 4 years planning for, when his latest indiscretion cost him his place in the side.
Mm. Yeah.
It's interesting, this. Without getting drawn too much on the Hales thing, I think people who haven't spent time in professional dressing rooms find it easier to feel sorry for him, or feel that he's been harshly dealt with, or feel that there is some kind of personal agenda against him. But when you've been in it and you live in each other's pockets day after day, week after week, year after year, that's a different reality, isn't it? And you're not the first ex-pro or current pro to say something similar to that. And Stokes, as you say in his book, unashamedly says, well, if he'd been world-class run scorer week after week, then we'd have probably looked at it in a different way.
We talked about it before, but I guess the argument is that in T20 cricket, he actually might be, he's closer to that than he was for the ODI stuff. And it's been 2 years.
Just a full stop then. You do think that he'll play again for England, do you?
Well, I've heard that they've been speaking, that Morgan and Hales have been speaking. I remember when Alistair Cook took over as captain, the pragmatic decision that Alistair Cook made to take KP on that tour of India. Alistair Cook, brand new captain of India. Who is our best player spin? Kevin Peterson. Am I going to leave him at home? Am I hell? Am I stupid? Of course I'm going to take him. So Alistair Cook went and spoke with Kevin, and they made sure that everything was sorted, and away they went, and they pulled off one of the great England away wins of all time. So, you know, these guys aren't, nothing happens in a bubble. Nothing happens in isolation, in a vacuum. Alex Hales will be looking at the T20 World Cup going, you know what, we could perhaps do with a little bit of extra firepower. We've got a whole batting lineup. Everybody wants to open the batting. We've got this bloke outside the team who wants to open the bat, et cetera, et cetera. Is there a way of making our winning the T20 World Cup more likely? And, you know, and you see, the interesting thing again with that is you go back to Jofra being picked late. That wasn't because he'd done anything wrong. It was just because England were getting into the run-up to the Cup. Everything was pretty much in place, but they were missing an ingredient. And lots of people went, oh, no, but you can't bring him in now. What about, you know, the team spirit dynamic. When you get up to the edge of the tournament and it becomes all about winning that tournament, this isn't about being on the road together for 4 years. Win the tournament. You can make a pragmatic decision based on what might be best, what's required in order to pull off that particular task. And then if it happens, if you win, great. You know, everything's forgotten. If you lose, he goes back on the outside again. And I have no issue with that either. You know, that's professional sport. It's not nice. You get left out, you get dumped, you get sacked, you disappear without a trace, having been brilliant beforehand. All of those things happen and it's all fair. It's all good in professional sport.
Without naming any names, were there times in your career where you played with blokes you just didn't really get on with?
Yes. Well, no, not that I didn't get on with, but I just thought
were much more trouble
than they were worth, yeah. And again, I say it again, in a county dressing room, where you are literally living with each other for that whole time, that becomes toxic. And if the return, as I say, if the returns aren't Hobbs-esque, then you go, sorry, pal, off you pop.
Is there not an argument that in international cricket now they spend so much time away from home that it is almost like a club dynamic?
Yeah, it is a little bit. It is a little. But again, you see...
The stakes are higher.
But the stakes are higher and the rewards are higher too. Mm. Now... Again, I don't know what the bonus structures are for winning Test series, winning One Day series, or whatever. But I'll wager they are a heck of a lot of money, hell of a lot of money. And so, if you've got some bloke in your side that's helping you win multiple Test match series year on year out, you kind of forgive them being a pain in the neck while you're away on the road. Mm. You all got single rooms. You can all do what you've all got enough money to do what you want anyway. You just ignore the bloke. You know, he wins you. But if he wins you a bunch of series, you're sticking all that in the bank, and the kids can go to private school, and you've bought your house, etc.
This is a feature that we're going to do later this summer in the magazine. The worst atmosphere dressing rooms in history.
Oh, really? That's really interesting.
Let's have a chat after this show.
I don't think I was ever in one of those, but I know a man who was.
Yeah, no, indeed. And so many stories that you hear over the years. Nana's used to write a column for All Out Cricket, which is like a precursor to Wisden and so on. And he wrote, he won the double out there in Australia, the 50 over and the Shield. And he said the dressing rooms, Queensland dressing room, I think it was absolute hell. Day after day, people openly fighting, physically as well as mentally. People having affairs with players' wives, the whole shebang, right? He said it was wild, and yet they were unbeatable. And I'm interested by that, because we hear lots of things about team unity and spirit.
Well, the Australia team that I spent all of my career beaten by. You know, they had cliques and factions in that, like you wouldn't believe, people that didn't get on. Mm. But it didn't matter. They crossed the line and they beat you up. Mm. You know, they were playing for something bigger than themselves in wanting Australia to win Test matches, and that's all that really matters. So it's, you know, you do not have to get on with the people you work with. I mean, you guys know that better than anyone.
Well, yeah.
Tell me about it. Talking of which, Ben has left the building.
If you're watching on YouTube, Ben has left the room because he's speaking to Matt Barkington.
He ghosted us.
That's fair enough.
A chat we might hear on next week's show.
Lovely.
I didn't expect us to get into that, but that was good. That was good fun.
Thanks, boss.
Yeah, this has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. Cheers, Phil. Cheers, Butch. Cheers, Ben.
Pleasure.
We'll be back next week. If you enjoy the show, hit the subscribe button. Tell your friends. And we'll see you next time. Cheers. Sports Social Podcast Network.